The music teacher says it was consensual sex. His former students say it was rape.
He had sex with me once in the classroom, in a closet.
Something happened to me too.
I thought he was our little predator.
Why wasn't he stopped? These women seek answers and justice. I'm Julie Ireton, host of a new podcast, The Banned Teacher. It's available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Just that somebody could be this diabolical.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Matt Galloway, and this is The Current Podcast.
Those dreams were pepping her up, were making her happy, were making her almost look forward to go to sleep. Seeing that and being a part of that is a gift. It was a gift for me. And I think it's a gift that should be shared.
That's Sue Oleksii talking about the dreams her mother had at the end of her life. For more than a decade, the dying have been sharing their dreams and visions with my next guest. Dr. Christopher Kerr studies these inner experiences to uncover their meaning for patients and their families. Dr. Kerr is Chief Executive Officer and Medical Officer at Hospice and Palliative Care at Buffalo in New York State. He's a Canadian, and he and his team have documented more than 1,500 end-of-life events to try to figure out what we dream about when we die. Dr. Kerr is in the studios of Public Radio in Buffalo. Dr. Kerr, good morning.
Good morning to you.
How would you characterize what Sue is talking about there?
She's referencing the inner experience of dying. Dying is this unique vantage point which changes one's perspective and perception, and this often includes profound dreams and visions.
A unique vantage point. Tell me more about why you would use that phrase.
It's obviously unlike anything else in the spectrum of life, and it naturally draws you inward. There's reflection, and often people focus on the best points of having lived and having mattered, and that's usually our relationships.
When did you first start to realize that people who were dying were having these sorts of dreams or these visions?
It's interesting because it was certainly nothing I was trained to appreciate. Medicine's about curing, not comforting necessarily when there's no cure. And when I started working at hospice, which was really by accident, I was just struck by so many of the patients I was seeing were actually sharing a reality that I didn't. What mattered really was it was so clearly therapeutic to them.
But some of this goes back to long before you became a doctor, right?
Yes, I was 12, and the last night I saw my father, we went fishing yearly, and he was looking kind of through me, and he was reaching for my shirt, telling me we had to get going. We were going to go on a trip up north in Ontario to go fishing. And I even knew at that time that I didn't know where he was, but where he was clearly put back together and in a very good spot.
Put back together. I mean, what do you think was going on with your dad?
I don't know where it comes from, but I think something happens at a very spiritual level in illness and towards the end that people are drawn to the best parts of themselves. And again, that usually focuses on the relationship to certain people, either the people who secured them, who they shared love with, who they gave love to, who matter.
How do you understand, we're calling these dreams, how do you understand what the dreams are? I mean, I think we all have dreams, and some of them are fantastical and some of them are pretty just straightforward. How do you understand what these dreams are?
We struggle with the nomenclature because if we're to be true to our patients, what they say repeatedly is these are not dreams. We actually measure realism on a 0 to 10 scale, with 10 being the most real or virtual. And most commonly, they rank them as 10 out of 10. They don't tend to be metaphorical or fantastical. They tend to be based on real lived events, and they don't require interpretation. What happens, I've never had a patient wake up and said, hey, I had this odd experience. What do you think it means? Mm-hmm. They just know intuitively. If you lost your child and they return to you, that just is what it is.
How do you go about doing this work in researching these end of life visions or dreams or whatever we want to call them?
Well, the work wrote a frustration in trying to get our medical community to at least recognize that these things matter to the patient. So we had to address the obvious criticisms. So we had to sort out that these people weren't, in fact, confused. So we screened for delirium or confusional states. And what we also did, because dying is a process, we interviewed them daily. And oftentimes we filmed them because we have this misconception that the dying are uniformly frail or confused, and they're frankly not.
And so you would speak with them every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And ask them
weeks
what?
And months. It was just a standardized questionnaire. What are you experiencing? Does it occur when you're asleep or awake? How real? We had a menu item of themes just to try to characterize the experience. And what we found is as people progress towards death, these experiences increased in frequency. And specifically, they focused on people who they loved and lost as they got near death. And when we looked at comfort, those were the most comforting experiences.
I want to play something from one of your patients. This is Jeannie Faber. She shared a vision with you before she died. Have a listen.
I was laying in bed, and people were walking very slowly by me. The right-hand side, I didn't know, but they were all very friendly, and they touched my arm or my hand when they went by. But the other side were people that I knew. My mom and dad were there, my uncle. Everybody I knew that was dead was there. And they passed and did the same thing. I feel good about it. I thought it was a good dream. I think more and more people are getting a little bit more hip to dreams than they were before.
What do you think is going on there?
She's pretty classic. So it's the thing that stands out in all of these is the absence of fear. When we envision the dying process from this perspective of health, it's immediately fear-laden. And that's not what they're describing. They don't seem unsettled. This feels natural to them. What's interesting is very little is said between the people in the dream and the people experiencing the dream, yet everything seems to be understood.
And she says that there were people that were familiar to her in that dream.
Yes, yes. She goes on to say, but I haven't seen my dog yet. And she knew she would see her dog. And
she knew that she would see her dog.
Yeah, yeah. She was learning as she was going through this that certain features of her life were coming to her. And she was waiting for her dog, and the dog does come just before her death.
And these are really comforting things to them.
Overwhelming. Roughly 88% are comforting, about 12% aren't. But what we got wrong was the ones that were discomforting were actually some of the most transformational.
How so?
Well, we've all been harmed or hurt. We've all lost for having lived. And often that gets addressed. We had a woman recently who had a child in prison. And she was questioning her identity and her worth as a mother. And at her end of life, her parents come to her and tell her she was a good mother and that she was loved.
And what does that tell you?
Again, it's this idea of being healed. We all have wounds, and that perhaps they're not dressed in living or through therapy, but that somehow they are towards the end. There seems to be some form of almost justice.
As you said, one of the criticisms around what we're talking about is that, and you've talked about this in your TEDx talk as well, that these can be dismissed as confusion, that people towards the end of their life may be medicated, they may be confused, delusional. How do you account for that?
Well, it's bothersome because medicine is so enamored with its science and not its art. It focuses on things that can be objectified and measured. And yet things that are more abstract, more subjective, are discounted. So we look at the physicality of dying, but there's this whole experiential side. And when it goes into the realm of spiritual, we're particularly discomfort from a medical model that looks at really people as organs that are failing at the end of life. And really, dying is what it always has been, which is the closing of a life.
And so you think that the characterization of these dreams by a medical community as being, the manifestations of confusion or of delirium, is part of that discounting of something larger, of a more spiritual dimension here?
Yeah, delirium is this kind of black box where you can put things in that you don't necessarily, you can't understand. Mm-hmm. And what's unfortunate is they're often medicated, which then sterilizes the person from their own dying experience.
I want to come back to this in a moment, but I mean, part of this is about, if you're explaining, if people hear your patients talking to them, talking to you in the conversations, in speaking with them, what did they say to you about how real these dreams are for those patients? We've all had those dreams where it seems incredibly real and we can't quite distinguish between, you know, what we're dreaming and what's happening in the real world. For your patients, how real were these visions that they were having?
Again, on a scale of realism, they were 10 out of 10. They mostly described them as a memory, as a happening. And oftentimes they get very defensive when it was refuted. So again, that's just problematic calling them dreams because they're so unusual and distinct from what we normally dream like. They feel it, but you know, they don't need to be validated. They act as though they lived it. So they're not looking for validation. And again, I've never had asked to have it refuted or confirmed. They just seem to know. Somehow this makes sense to the dying, even children.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to play another example from one of your patients. This is Jennifer McNatty talking about her partner, Patrick, and his dream of his deceased grandmother. They both shared a love of her spaghetti sauce. Have a listen.
Patrick was the only member of his family that knows how to make the sauce. And for all the years I knew him, he insisted something was missing. Fast forward to this would be the Sunday before he passed. He woke up in the morning and I couldn't get him to eat. And he's like, oh, no, I ate with Nana Dolores last night. Said he could smell it. He could still taste it. He was full from it. And she showed him, after all these years, what he had done wrong, which is the very last step before you take it off the burner was to add a teaspoon of sugar. It was so very real for him, to the point, there I am, putting on sweatpants, driving to the grocery store, because we spent the next 7.5 hours, because that's how long it takes, making his grandmother's sauce that day, and he was so sick, and it was the only day I was ever allowed to help him. We made the sauce, he added the sugar, last time Patrick ever ate. Every morning he woke up saying, is today the day I'm gonna die? And I said, you'll go when you're ready. And he was ready. It's made me think of, maybe there is something out there after we go.
How unusual is that, to have questions answered in these dreams?
It's more common than not. And it's interesting because they often go back in such detail that they recall memories that they wouldn't necessarily had access to otherwise. I kind of view it as the same way if you hear an old song on the radio and you're flooded with recollections from high school. It's kind of that same thing. So, I mean, he'd gone his whole adult life not knowing the missing element of the recipe. And then at the end of his life, it comes to him. And he actually felt full when he would sleep and eat with his grandmother.
You've also spoken with young people,
mm-hmm,
who are dying?
Yes, many.
And what do they experience?
It's interesting. I struggled a lot as a doctor, just how to communicate to a child where they were in their disease trajectory. And what was fascinating is so many of them became self-informed from these experiences. Often children don't have language for mortality or finality, and they may not know an adult who has died, but they will know a pet, whether it's a neighbor's, a grandparent's, whatever. And often the experience is the same. And children actually do it better. They don't make the distinction between the creative or the animal world and reality. So they'll often see a pet that has died, but they'll see the pet in life. And we've had several children, we've written cases of these, where they'll say the same thing. You know, I'm not alone, and I'm loved.
What's going on here, do you think? Broadly, I mean, when we talk about this, you're a neurobiologist as well, in addition to working in palliative care. What's going on here, do you think?
You know, I got stuck on that, and the curiosity and the desire to find the etiology or the cause, I had to abandon, because what it does, it obscures the significance of it. Because I don't know doesn't mean that it isn't significant to the patient. So where I end up is I have no clue. I just know that it's more common than not. It's wonderfully therapeutic and brings comfort in a way that I can't to the dying. And that really, I just have reverence for it. I'm comfortable not knowing.
In your TEDx talk, you said that you have a deep aversion to the non-physical spiritual aspects of dying.
Yeah, I was as trained as a scientist and a physician. So I did. I was, like many young doctors, I was so spectacularly fascinated by what we could do to people and for people. And the acts of doing an intervention became entrancing. And when I was forced to when I worked at hospice, it was learning that there's this other role where you can be a comforter and you can be present. And that matters. And that was really a point of learning then. I was able to understand better what their experience was.
You also said that in our culture, the richest and most thoughtful discussions have always come from the humanities, never from medicine. What is medicine ignoring here, do you think? What's it afraid of?
I think as time goes on, we go toward the direction of science, and particularly with technology and all the wonders that can be done. But we've let go of the art part of medicine. There was a time when our grandparents were living where doctors often were faced with futility, but that wasn't associated with abandonment. Now we have all this almost institutional abandonment. We go to hospitals and to have things done.
That's why you said earlier that this is about curing. It's not about comforting.
Yeah, yeah. And we've lost that. And it's unfortunate, because when you pause and you become that kind of physician, that's where some of the deepest meaning is found.
Are you a spiritual person?
No, not by disposition. I'm the sort of person who, if you offered me to go to a seance or have a reading, I'd just pass. I was reluctantly brought to this. And again, it really forced me to get beyond my own discomfiture.
But I just wonder how something like this is influenced by spirituality, how it's influenced by faith and religion.
Yeah, I think it is, and that's part of the problem. I think the messaging on this had to be very clear, that we weren't trying to interpret this towards the afterlife or religiosity or paranormal. We were looking at dying just as a mystery unto itself, and really we were very disciplined on taking the words and experiences of our patient without extrapolating. So I think it helped to have some discomfort with it, because I wasn't anxious to go there anyway.
You said you had to be careful. I mean, because people could misinterpret this. They could say that you are talking about an afterlife, that you're talking about the paranormal, and they might dismiss it if they don't believe that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I started off holding the wrong end of the stick, really. I was trying to convince physicians that this mattered, which turned out to be pretty futile. But to do that, I knew as soon as I strayed into any other waters of what lies beyond the veil kind of thing, that I would lose the audience.
Tell me more about how your colleagues in medicine reacted when you talk to them about the work that you're doing.
Well, there are certainly some that have had experience. I know some oncologists, for example, who this is, you know, their bread and butter practice for them. But I know a lot that aren't, particularly the young, who haven't seen someone die. What's interesting is the amount of people, if they recognize this, it's often because they've seen it in their own life, just like I did. But what's fascinating is we heard crickets when we published in the medical journals for which it was meant for, but it's never stopped going around the world. So there's this dichotomy then between the people who are providing care and those that are receiving it.
What do you think these dreams mean to the loved ones who are around the person who is dying?
Enormously important. I mean, how people leave us matters. Death is either seen as empty and, organ failure and decay, or it's something that's rich in meaning and life-affirming. And we've done several studies on this with 750 bereaved, and what's good for the patient is good for their loved ones. You know, if you have a couple and they lost a child together, and one's looking down on their life partner of six decades, and that person is holding the child that was lost, that completely inverts dying to something from empty to something rich in love.
How should that, or how has it then shaped the work that you do in palliative care?
Oh, enormously. What we do is we translate a lot of this. Our job is to get people closer to the bedside, the discomfort around dying, and telling them that this is common, that it's usually comforting, and to pull into it often removes some of the, because people fear, is this medication, is this metastasis to the brain, et cetera.
Yeah. And so what do you say to those who are around the patient in palliative care? Because part of it is palliative care is for the patient, but it's also for their loved ones.
Yeah, the unit of care is always not just the patient, but their loved ones. So we try to bring them into the experience by normalizing it, by giving it permission to, again, saying that this is common and you can ask about it. You know, dying's lonely, and anything that makes the patient feel less isolated is to the good.
What would you say to people who are listening to this who have an eyebrow raised and think, come on, come on, somebody is dying and we can try to interpret any number of things that might be happening, but this seems like a stretch too far.
Well, I think the thing I would stress is you really have to, that's why the videos are so important, is I'm not sure I would listen to me, but if you see people who look and sound like us, who are cognitively intact, who are acutely aware, and with absolute clarity, they're telling you something with absolute conviction that this is their happening, and you see it again and again and again. And there's universal themes and trends to these experiences that, you know, it just has to be, there has to be some reference for it.
I mean, this will happen to all of us.
Yes.
Hopefully not for a long time, but who knows when. And it's the great mystery, right? You can talk a lot about it and people may have theories and ideas, but until it happens to you, you don't actually know what's going on. How has doing this work shaped your own views about death and dying?
You know, I'm certainly not as scared of the actual dying process. But, you know, I am a cancer patient. I'm doing well. But I can tell you that I'm scared as the next person. All the psychogenic trauma that everyone experiences, I've certainly experienced. The concern, and we see this all the time, there's this great story within dying, whereas the concern doesn't transitions from self to others. And you know, it's, in my case, it's the fact that I have children. And so I have an unfinished life, so I feel as frightened to leave until I feel that's more complete. But in the actual process, I'm less fearful of.
And does what you have heard from your patients give you some comfort? Does that help ameliorate some of that fear? I mean, death is a scary thing.
Oh, absolutely. The thing, if you watch these videos in series or you do this work, what's so interesting is the absence of fear, this whole notion of fighting the dying of the light. That's what you say from relative health and the vibrancy. I mean, that's what that innate will to live and to fight is what keeps us forward. But actually, you know, as when people reach the point when there is no cure, hope does transition and people do reach acceptance. So there's this absolute, for most of our patients, really they're not talking in states of fear. A lot of our patients who are kind of in two worlds between their dream world and the reality are often pulled more preferentially to what they're experiencing when their eyes are closed and open.
And it's like a moment of beauty in a really difficult time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
This is really interesting work. I'm glad to talk to you about it. I wish you the very best of health as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
But this is fascinating. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Christopher Kerr is the Chief Executive and Medical Officer at Hospice and Palliative Care Buffalo, and he is the author of Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.